Hey guys, welcome to the RLW show. In this case, it's the first edition of something I'm trying called Robert Interviews an Atheist. I have a decent number of skeptical friends in my life. And since I like to have that dialogue and that sharing of ideas and growing in knowledge by talking to opposing viewpoints, that's what we're giving it a try today. So this is the very first time we're doing this. And my guest today is Ryan Price, living out there in Denver, right?
Correct.
I first encountered Ryan as that dreaded creature, the internet atheist, because he, I think one of my random blog posts, I was just starting out sort of, I was trying Facebook ads. And so, which actually worked pretty well. And I would have to look back which post it was, but Ryan commented on it and we started an exchange. And actually we've probably had three or four exchanges on different topics. But I've always really enjoyed them because you were clearly someone who was much more thoughtful and took it seriously and seems well read too. Obviously the internet is often the worst place for dialogue, so it's always great to actually have a good exchange, and I feel like we've had some really good exchanges already.
Yeah, totally. Even though
it's just been over text, but we've talked about, I think you've watched most of my epistemology stuff, if not all of it, and we had some good interactions on that. We had a long back and forth about miracles, and I'm really excited. We'll see. I'm not sure we'll get to that today, but I'm still working on that sort of as a research project. So I'm going to be very curious to hear your thoughts on some of that stuff. And then recently had a quick discussion on like the unity of consciousness and dualism, which was really interesting, based on an article from Christianity Today, that was arguing from the idea that you can't divide the will and the self. Anyway, it was really interesting. So my very first question for you, Ryan, is why in the world is your Hangouts handle Dr. Rog's Office?
Well, I've gone through a lot of different artist names, I would say, over time. And Dr. Rog happened to be one that I think my friends just kind of gave me as some sort of, it's like a combination of Dr. Dre and D-O-double-G, but with R-O-double-G.
Okay, so it's like, it's your like musician artist name.
Yes, it's my most recent incarnation of a musician artist name.
Okay, awesome. What has been some in the past?
The one I like and that I'll probably end up using in the long run is Slounge. Spelled P-S-Y Lounge. That's my favorite because I think it describes my music best. I've used SPQ, which is an abbreviation people use to talk about the quality of speakers. And those are essentially, I use different names depending on the project and what I want. Eventually, I'll stick with one once I think they all sound like one finished work.
Nice. And honestly, I totally forgot you're a musician. I have a knack apparently for like finding people with like all sorts of shared interests, because one of the other guys that I'm going to hopefully meet up to do one of these interviews with, who I also randomly met online through my blog, is also a musician. He's a drummer in a band. So I love that connection. So like what type of music do you do?
I make sound design more than I make anything else. So I'm more into the production end of things. I'm like a, I don't know what to call it, like a Brian Eno calls himself a non-musician because he doesn't really play instruments. He just uses instruments and makes music out of them. And I'd say
okay.
I'm more on that level where I can play a synth and I know what scale I'm in and I know those things, but I don't really have technical skills like a musician has or anything. I'm more conceptually putting together original pieces of music than I am skilled at performing other people's music.
Okay, so is it almost like some soundscape type stuff?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I would love to share like some links to some of your stuff when I post this. Do you have SoundCloud or?
I have one song available on YouTube, and hopefully by the end of this year, I'll have about an album's worth of songs also to add to that list on YouTube.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll make sure to get that from you because I'd love to hear some of your stuff.
Thank you.
And are you a musician by trade, or are you, what's your day job if not crafting soundscapes?
I make my money by taking care of people's dogs. So
nice.
I'm a dog caretaker, yes.
You would fit in well in Brooklyn because a lot of people are dog walkers here.
Yeah, dog walking is a good way to make money. Dog boarding, taking care of people's dogs is a little better if you can find some good dogs to take care of. I have my favorite dog here today.
So wait, are you like people drop off their dog and you watch them while they're on vacation or?
Yeah, or whether they go to work, or some people just want to go hang out in the mountains with their spouses for a couple days and they want to just not take their dog, but want them to be taken care of or whatever. And I have a availability and they just try to find if I'm available.
Nice.
I have a lot of good reviews.
nice. I didn't realize we're doing a promotional material, but we'd like to add to your ad exposure there. Yeah, so I'm just curious, obviously you get into, you're, you know, reasonably well-read, you are interested in a lot of different topics, but if we went wound back the clock a little bit, I'm probably most curious just like your story as far as like, did you grow up in a religious household, non-religious, if there is a big arc there into out of faith, anything like that. I'm just curious how you got to where you are now.
I was raised Catholic. I went to a Catholic school and pretty much I was confirmed, everything pretty much through eighth grade. Didn't really have a lot of, shouldn't say I don't have any doubts. I definitely had doubts by eighth grade, but I still would say I believed at that point. Then it kind of became, I said I believed in high school, but I didn't really care that I did. And just like an identifier I used with other people. And then after high school, I would say I kind of lost the Christianity aspect of it and the tradition aspect of it, but I still wanted to believe in God. And so I slowly kind of worked my way towards maybe something more pantheistic and just believing that the universe was God. And by the time that I was at the point where I was realizing I believed that the universe was God, I happened to watch a video, and I don't remember who I was watching, but they said, if you believe that you're going to call God the universe, why don't you just call the universe and study that? And that really appealed to me, and I was like, all right, maybe I'm just trying to believe in God because I want to and not because I actually do.
And so that was in high school?
That was a few years after high school. That was maybe between eighth grade and after that was like transition towards pantheism. But pantheism was the realization that I kind of don't really believe in a being. I just believe in reality.
And then why not call that reality what it is, the universe?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And then did it kind of develop? Did you start reading atheist authors? Like how did it develop from there?
Well, I think that I was already looking at atheists before that because they were making good points against. So I kind of found a home with some atheist thinking even when I wasn't an atheist because they were very reasonable. And all of the things that I would say that were like hypocritical about the Catholic Church and things like that, they were the ones who were really saying all of that. So I had already heard of some of the more famous ones. And then by then, once you had heard their points against your old religion, you start hearing their points against all other religions. And
right. It
was hard for me to really want to stick to any other one. And that's
pretty
much all there was to it, yeah.
And so, yeah, that helps fill in the picture of like kind of how you got to where you are now. But obviously, you just seem to be interested in a lot of these ideas in general, like philosophy, science, like you seem to be at least familiar with even some relativity theory in one of our back and forths. Like, can you describe your interest for that? Does that go back to when you were a kid being interested in philosophy or science and that sort of stuff?
Definitely. I would say that I was always definitely the science kid in my class for the most part, nerdy kid. But as I think that just believing in God and trying to understand the universe were kind of the same thing for me. So it's just once I lost faith in anything that I felt superstitious about and didn't need to explain anything, it was more, I still wanted to explain everything else. I was still interested in physics like I was interested in God before, but it just seemed like I didn't need God to really explain any of the things. He was no longer a mechanism to me. So I was still interested in the world, but he didn't seem to be part of it anymore. So it was, my interest was, I'm just as fascinated with God as at that time as I was with physics. And slowly that just became like, oh, I think I'm flunking that a little bit.
Gotcha. What do you have specific people, specific authors, thinkers that like either influenced you or have become favorites? I know you recommended one Sam Harris thing for me. Are you a pretty big Sam Harris fan?
I would say Sam Harris probably I agree with the most often, and he says things in the way that I would advocate the way he's saying what he's saying over things like maybe Richard Dawkins is a very famous atheist, for example, but he's not as careful with what he says. He's more just like cold and calculated and scientific, which is really good for what he's doing, but not necessarily good for communicating with everybody necessarily.
Right, right. Are you reading or studying anything in particular right now? What's like capturing your interests right now?
Right now, I am in between slowly reading Waking Up by Sam Harris.
Okay.
After that, I haven't decided which of these books is next, but I guess we'll just work one by one.
What are some example books on your shelf that you would like to get to?
Oh, well, I can go see. All right. So these are the books that I'm trying to get to. I have Quantum Electrodynamics by Richard Feynman.
Nice.
Because he makes quantum mechanics fun. Consciousness in the Brain. I could not pronounce that author, but this was highly recommended by everyone who told me that I should try to understand consciousness better.
Interesting.
It's called by Stanislas D. Helen. I don't know. There you go.
Got it.
That person deserves a shout. And then this wonderful book, which I have not started yet.
Yes.
That you were reading.
Oh, man. I forgot you had that.
I haven't started it yet.
It is the most, it's probably the most fascinating book I've ever read. It's really, really great.
I look forward.
Awesome. It's just one of those books that gets you thinking about all these concepts that you either haven't thought before or just haven't pondered the same amount and just exercises your brain in that way.
Definitely the best.
And it sounds like you do have a distinct interest in like consciousness, the nature of consciousness.
Yeah, I think that's like core to everything. That's the most, without focus on that, you pretty much have no reason to focus on anything else.
Yes, it's actually interesting you say that because I have started to realize how fundamental consciousness is. I guess from even a materialistic viewpoint. Yeah, from a materialistic viewpoint as well, because like even morality, you could argue, sort of reduces to consciousness in the sense that if there's no true consciousness anywhere in the universe, then there's basically no suffering, because that presupposes consciousness, and therefore morality almost seems to disappear, because who cares if a rock falls off a cliff on a tree? Like,
right, even if it felt pain but didn't know it.
Right.
If a person falls off a cliff into a tree, if they don't know they did.
Right. So anyway, it made me realize how fundamental consciousness is. So maybe we'll have to get into that later or talk about it another time. So I'm just curious, like, do you ever, either in the past or more recently, is there anything that ever makes you think, wait, could there be either a God or something supernatural? Does anything ever like just pique your curiosity in that way or not really?
It's never a go-to explanation anymore, I would put it that way.
Yeah.
When other people talk to me about it, I'm willing to consider it as a hypothesis for explanations for things, but I don't even know what I would be trying to imagine. And so the problem is when I'm trying to explain something, usually I want to understand that the particles in the water get hot and that is why it evaporates, because it disbands, it becomes gas. And I right. can understand the mechanisms of what's actually happening. I don't understand what I'm even supposed to be imagining with a God mechanism. So it's hard gotcha. For me to put that in there as an explanation.
Okay. So, yeah, nothing makes you, it's not a regular part of your life to say, wait a second, could ghosts be real? Could, you're generally comfortable in your, would you call yourself a materialist?
It depends on what you mean by that. I don't think that matter is the only thing that exists. I think that matter is a form of energy, and there's a more esoteric way of looking at things. It's more mathematical and relationship oriented than substantial. I believe that that kind of rules what matter does, if you think that that's a higher power, but I don't really think.
Okay.
Like the Einstein's God, I could understand why calling that God for simplicity's sake, but I don't think that anyone's really proposing that that is a being.
It's not really a personal something. God. Right.
Yeah. It's not a mind.
Right. Right. That makes sense. And I'm curious, like, have you just over the years read or encountered much like more sophisticated Christian authors or teachers, like C.S. Lewis or someone like that?
Yes. And I say right when I first started losing faith, my dad gave me a C.S. Lewis book. I've heard every debate that most famous atheists have had. So if someone is a debater, I've probably heard that debate. I was into that a lot for a while.
Have you watched a lot of William Lane Craig?
Yeah, yeah. I've seen him debate pretty much anybody. I've seen him debate Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens.
What do you think of him and the arguments he uses?
My favorite way to put what I think of him is when he debated Sean Carroll. Sean yes. Carroll definitely kind of exposed William Lane Craig for being a little insincere to me in ways that I think other people can't, because he's actually very educated. So mm-hmm. I think he knows what he's talking about, but he kind of just talks past everybody, admittedly. Like he says that if there was a evidence that really was to convince him that there wasn't a God, that the witness of the Holy Spirit inside of himself should override that, which to me means no matter what, you're going to believe in God. No matter what anybody says to you, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. This debate is irrelevant to you, and you're just kind of making points because it's fun for you.
Right. Yeah. So that gets into Reformed epistemology, which he subscribes to, along with Alvin Plantinga, if you've encountered him at all. And I get where they're coming from, and I don't necessarily disagree, but he admits it's not an argument for the existence of God. It's just the idea. Ultimately, I do agree with this. I don't put a focus on it, and I don't know if I hold to it as strongly as those two do, but like ultimately the idea is that suppose there is a God, then he could put in us an innate knowledge of him. And if we have it, then there shouldn't necessarily need to be other things to convince us. But obviously, it just, if you're trying to explain that to someone in a debate, it's not an argument.
Plus, it's also then not innate knowledge. You have to explain it to someone that they have it.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you could then argue why do you have it?
You have to tell me. Why do you have to tell me I have innate knowledge to remind me? Why do other people have different innate knowledge?
Right. And with some of the insincerity thing, did that have to do with the, I think it's called the Boyd-Guth-Vilenkin theorem about the beginning of the universe and how, because I know Sean Carroll showed like pictures of one of the authors saying he disagreed.
I don't think that was I don't think that particular thing was insincere. I think he was just kind of trying to rationalize his point still. And yeah, I think he was just, it's hard to debate John Carroll on physics for sure.
Right. Wait, what was the insincere part? I'm just
The insincerity is more that I have heard him be corrected on things like that and essentially ignore whatever he's been told. I've also heard him when he debated Lawrence Krauss.
Yes.
Lawrence Krauss ended up publishing a lot of information that was, I don't know what to call it, lying insincere, because I'm not really a part of any of that. But
right.
From a spectator's point of view, it seems like he knows better than some of the things he says, but it doesn't really support his conclusion to know that he knows better than some of the things he says. And that to me is at least intellectually dishonest, if it's not just straight up being insincere.
Right. Well, since I am a WLC fan, in his defense, first of all, he's a bit of a robot. He also does not, he comes across like he just wants to win a debate sometimes rather than show what one would think is like the grace and charity that you would get from Jesus. I mean, sometimes like he's not awful, you know, but it becomes like, it's almost like watching someone play basketball who's getting into the game. And it's like, well, wait, is this what this should be? Like, a competitive sport, because he was like a star debater in high school and stuff. Yeah, when it comes to whenever I've dug into some of the more esoteric points, like the post debate blog post between him and the other person, I think it's always ended up being a little bit he said, she said, and I've never been able to feel I've never felt the way you have that, oh, it seems like he definitely didn't know. Or he definitely knew that that wasn't true or something like that. But I have witnessed some of that back and forth, and I know what you're talking about. And that's actually one thing I try really hard to do. And obviously it's hard when, you know, I'm not a professional philosopher. I've had limited time to study this stuff, but one of my number one goals is honesty, because in some ways I felt lied to by Christians. Maybe mostly accidentally, but given false information as Christians, as far as the more super conservative fundamentalist side, and that is really harmful, I think, ultimately. So I think honesty is the most important thing. Like, I'd rather someone say, I believe this crazy extreme thing, and I know that, you know, I don't know the evidence for it. I don't know if there is evidence for it, but I just believe it. That's so much better than saying, oh, it's totally true, and you're being deceived by the secular world. And if you just only looked at the data, you would see that clearly this is true. You know, pick your, you know, fundamentalist belief. So I'm sensitive to that. And like, I hate when anytime, like, you know, a Christian apologist comes across insincere or something like that. But you have to admit, William Lane Craig, he's a force still. Like, I mean, eye roll.
He's an interesting debater. He's good at debates. I don't know if he's good at convincing anyone who's not already convinced he's right, but that's.
Well, we can let the listener, viewer decide for themselves. There's a lot of great debates out there. The Sean Carroll one is one of the most technical. I do not recommend it for jumping in, starting. I mean, there's some really fun ones with like Christopher Hitchens, and you just pick a popular one. It's definitely a spectacle to watch him debate someone, for sure, I would say. I feel like I've gotten... gotten a pretty good picture of where you're at. I'm curious, like, do you have Christians like me that you debate with, or like, how often does this sort of thing happen for you? Are you on the message boards telling Christians they're wrong all the time, or
only when they're regularly posting? I can hear myself twice right now. So I'm only telling Christians they're wrong when I notice that they have some sort of, I don't know how to say this, So, for example, I'm on a group from a town that I used to come from, and they post a lot of perfectly fine things about God, like just things that they're doing at their church, and little say amen thing here, God is good. And I mean, I will argue with some of the logistics of things, but I don't really care if people are just being good. I care if they're doing things like, here's a good thing that I'm doing, and it's all in the name of God, and they go on for about three more paragraphs about how great God is, and then they just defend all of the claims they made about God by saying, how dare you come after me? I'm doing all these good things that I said in the first sentence.
Right.
Like, well, when, I think so. I don't go after people until their opinions are public, and I will defend myself from people who I think are absurd. But other than that, I don't really care if people believe, but I think it's detrimental. I don't think I can do anything about it personally, but I do think that it is detrimental to people's ability to actually understand nature, and not really, which I'm not sure how far that depth of that really affects.
Yeah, no, I feel you with that. And just so the listener viewer knows, Ryan has only been nice when I've interacted with him. It's been some spirited debates, but I've enjoyed interacting with you because you aren't the stereotype on either side. P.S. Oh my gosh, you should. I don't know how many of the comments you've seen on some of my posts, but when I've done the ads, but there have been ridiculous people on both sides. I'll just say.
I would agree. Completely agree.
Anyway, well, thanks for sharing a bit of your story and being willing to talk about that on this video. You had an idea. I kind of asked you what ideas you had for this discussion, and what you brought up, which I thought was great, was that each of us could think of one thing we value in the other side, kind of. And talk about that. So, do you want to take it first?
I'll definitely go first. I know that I respect not necessarily Christianity, but religious points of view, because once I became an atheist, once I realized I was an atheist, I would essentially associate with other atheists a lot more simply and realize that if they were an atheist since they were born, there is a significantly greater chance that they are not really interested in how the universe works, and that they're just as day-to-day as anybody else is. And I think that just believing that there is God and having this sort of bigger picture given to you to think about, whether it's true or not, it doesn't even matter. It makes people actually think about things on that level. It definitely prevents some people from thinking because they think they already have the answer. But I definitely wouldn't be where I am right now if it wasn't for, I mean, I just assumed there was an answer to be found already and eventually I would understand it. But just that pursuit, that curiosity, I know that science itself comes from religious endeavors to better understand how God works. So everything that I care about comes from essentially people like you hundreds of years ago, slowly
right.
turning into the positions that I think of now. And you disagree with a little bit, but it's...
Right.
I wouldn't be here if I, so I have to respect that, or I don't respect my own opinion.
So is it, so can you just describe again, like someone who's like born an atheist, what is the thing that is missing that doesn't, is it just because when you have the idea of God, there's immediately this thing to be curious about, like, what is God and how did all this work? And if you're an atheist from the beginning, it's more like, well, this is all we got. And I don't know. Yeah. What do you rephrase
a little? Yeah, I think that's a little simplified, but mostly the right idea. So I think you just, if you tell somebody that there's something in space watching them and that they cares about what you do, that's an interesting idea. And if you never tell your kid that and they never come up with that idea or never encounter that idea anywhere else, then they're only going to really interact with their environment. And they might become superstitious for other reasons, like an animalistic trait has become superstitious. But I don't think that... I mean, some of the greatest thinkers of all time were never Christian. So a little asterisk, I suppose, for those people. But I would think most people who have ever contributed to any of the information I ever cared about were religious through most of history. and they were motivated by actually caring about the fact that they did believe in God and that there was actually something to learn. And as long as you think that there's something to learn, then I'm with you.
That's really cool. I've never really heard that line taken by a skeptic, I would say, because I think I hear what you mentioned a little bit, which is that when you think you already have all the answers in this one book or whatnot, then why go out and look into anything? Which I'm glad you recognize is, while that might be true of some, obviously that wasn't true of, you know, famous Christian scientists throughout the ages and stuff like that.
Most people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you brought up another interesting point that I have been thinking a lot about, which is the fact that this is a quote from, do you know Michael Ruse? I think he's debated William Lane Craig. He's a atheist philosopher of science at Florida State.
I don't think so.
Okay. I watched him in debate with John Lennox, if you've heard of him. And one quote that I wanted to write down for my own debates one day, but I really liked, is he said, which just surprised me, he admitted this. He said, modern science owes its basic existence to Christianity. He said, I recognize that. And it's really amazing to hear you at least lean that direction too, because I would say the vast majority of people out there think the opposite. All they think of is Galileo being rejected by the church, and obviously more modern stuff with evolution and age of the earth and stem cells, you know, whatever you want to, you know, pick. And it's like the church repressing science, you know, and there's been plenty of that too. I'm not going to pretend that, but the argument I hear is that Christianity gave the worldview of that nature itself was not chaotic. It was ordered because it was created by an ordered God, and it wasn't imbued with spirits everywhere. And so it was not wrong to dissect it, essentially. And that kind of opened the door. But I find that really fascinating. What do you make of that? Like, do you think it's just a coincidence that like some worldview had to have some extra spice and it happened to be the Christian one or Judeo-Christian?
I think what made it happen to be the Judeo-Christian one is they want all the wars in the long run. So ultimately, I think that people believe things because they're superstitious. They get a reward for doing something, like it rains or just whatever they wanted to do, and they think that whatever they were doing right before they got what they wanted must have been why that thing happened. So then they start repeating things like, well, I was praying and I was believing that something would help, and then something did help because the thing I was hoping for happened, and a bunch of other people can come together on that idea. And in a long time ago, when a lot of people would come together over ideas, it would protect you from like big cats and things like that, things you definitely don't want to be alone around. And so it was beneficial to believe the same things as all the people around you. And that just kind of got hardwired into us. And we'll fight over, no, we're right, no, we're right, no, we're right. But we're all just kind of believing whatever superstitious things our grandparents, grandparents, grandparents believed in order to make the cohesion happen originally. And I think Christianity is the one that has won that the most. It won the superstition battle and has most affected reality.
But why does it, I guess my question is more, why does it seem like Christianity was fertile soil for scientific endeavor? So let me give you, in another debate I heard recently, the Christian brought up that this, I can't remember his name, I'd have to look it up, but did a massive study on China and why it was technologically advanced for hundreds of years, but never actually developed science per se, like the scientific method. And he came up with like three or four primary reasons after doing this massive lifetime study. And one of them was essentially like a doctrine of creation, of that there is an ordered universe that we are meant to investigate. So this guy's argument would be that if China had been the superpower and its traditions were the superstitions that won, that, you know, maybe eventually would have gotten science, but it wasn't nearly as fertile ground, and that's why it didn't develop over there.
Okay, so I do think that Christianity promotes the idea of looking at things like you said, like it's okay to look at the world because it's not spiritually inhabited, so we are allowed to know about those things. It definitely did that. But I think that it really wouldn't matter which superstition was the prevalent one, I don't think, because they're all trying to do the same thing, which is explain why we're getting what we're getting when we are. So it's just, they're all just trying to explain the world either way. And so because of that, there's going to slowly be more people in every community that will want, like, they'll do better. You'll have your next Einstein of the next generation and the next Einstein of the next generation. And it'll always revise the way that model is worked with, and eventually it'll look nothing like the original superstition, and that's a totally different view, which now is science, but it's not betraying Christianity per se. It's just no longer obeys its principles of investigation. There, it allows for deeper investigation than Christianity itself will allow.
Right. Actually, yeah, you could ultimately say at least one strand of it does betray Christianity, because if Christianity created modern science, then that created the modern atheist. You know, like it, as Richard Dawkins says, you know, evolution made atheism intellectually tenable. Yeah, it is ironic that if Christianity was the fertile ground for modern science, then science was the fertile ground for questioning it all the way down to the bottom. So yeah, it's an interesting circular path there. Yeah, so it sounds like with when it comes to the Judeo-Christian worldview, or really just the Jewish worldview about creation, that it's not particularly meaningful that it was more fertile ground, that one of the superstitions, at some point the scientific method would develop, but you do acknowledge that it's at least quite possible that the Jewish was a more fertile ground than other superstitions.
Yeah, it might have taken longer if it was a different religion. It might have, but I think people would have figured out science just by being curious.
Right. Cool. Yeah, no, that's cool. I like your answer to that. It's kind of, like I said, I've never heard an atheist take that route. And it's funny because my answer is actually similar to yours. We're both being very complimentary to the opposite side here, because I'm going to sort of ascribe a lot of what you just said to the other side, which is the thing, I think the immediately comes to mind when I think of skepticism and atheism is the skepticism itself. I really, like I said, I think honesty is one of the most important things, and if honesty is top, then like truth is next, as far as understanding the world. I really value the courage of skepticism, essentially, because throughout my life, I really do feel like it is crucial to live the healthiest life possible, to ultimately hold any of our ideas in an open hand, ready to give it up if it seems false. And it's very, very hard to do that. I mean, it took years for me to even, you know, self-question things about my own identity that you just naturally gain as you grow up. And there's these core things that are a part of your identity when you get to, you know, high school, college, whatever. And even that, just simply questioning there's certain things it's like, no, I won't question that. I'm the nice guy. I have to be the nice guy. If I couldn't have done something mean, you know, just whatever it is. Or like for me, like being good at music or basketball. I actually wrote about how I used being good at basketball as an exercise for this when I was first going through this. And not only, so I guess a lot of this stuff we talk about, Ryan, can sound very dry and detached from relational life, kind of. But for me, what I value so much and what I value in skepticism is how it's improved me as a person and my relationships, because it's just that willingness to really grit your teeth and say, what if I'm wrong in this argument, or I'm the one that screwed up? And for me, it feels the exact same to do that than as it is to say, what if the Bible is false? What if there isn't a God? What if the weird charismatic gifts are real and I have to go start speaking in tongues? Oh, crap. Just any of those. I've just realized that it is a crucial tool of life to have that, to be willing to turn over every rock and to question everything. I would say most people don't go all the way with it. It's hard to, and obviously you can't question everything all the time, but I really value, you could just say critical thinking. Like I hate that critical thinking isn't taught the same way in school as it used to be, as far as like rhetoric and logic, just because it's just like a basic tool of life. And so I really value that. And I never want to take that away from a lot of atheist thinkers, I value the fact that they're willing to question the norm, question the comfortable beliefs. I try to do that myself. So,
I'm pretty much agree with everything you just said. I don't know. I have nothing to add.
Amazing. I love it. But I like how our answers are kind of mirror images, because you were saying you value how faith can actually make you curious about what's out there and stuff like that. So, and obviously I'm a Christian, and I agree with that part too, that, I think you can have a positive and a negative, because there absolutely are religious people it becomes this, either this thing they don't want to question, or a place where you just stop investigation as well. I think skepticism can also almost go too far, or just not have a stopping point or something.
Yeah, people can be so skeptical that they become cynical and not really even considering anything anymore.
Right. Obviously, if you just stay in utter skepticism, you're just like in stasis. You're not able to do anything or make any decision.
The point of being skeptical is to not believe false things, but not so, you don't want to do it so that you'll never find out the truth, because you just think everything might be.
Yes. So one of my favorite authors, N.T. Wright, says, I think he's quoting someone else, but he says, the point of an open mind is the same as an open mouth, so you can shut it on something solid. So it's the same kind of idea, that you don't just keep everything in suspension forever. You try to find the truth. And I think the key for me is the emotional attachment to those propositions, so that you do study. So you go out and you do your studying and you say, okay, I think this is true. But ultimately, I think the healthy thing is for it to be in an open hand where that can be questioned later. That's the challenging thing. I think that's the hardest thing, actually. It's easy to be, in one sense, an utter skeptic and say, well, I'm just never going to hold to any truths. And it's also easy to have false confidence and say, well, I'm just going to stick with what I have believed in the past. I think the hard path is trying to figure out what's true, holding on to it, but then if it's questioned to a point where you need to give it up, being willing to give it up. That's what's tough, because then you're being jerked back and forth potentially. And you are during life, like you know, paradigm changes.
I don't think not believing in God was the hardest thing I ever had to give up. I kind of think, so as far as my skepticism goes, the biggest blow my skepticism has ever given me was probably free will.
Okay, interesting.
Because I understand why it appears that I have free will, still yet, even though I know that I don't. I actually think that I could say that I know that I don't, and that's not really a debate, unless you want to take like a special Dan Dennett form of free will, where free will just means you're not being forced to do something by somebody else.
Where free will means determinism.
I essentially do believe in determinism, but I just think that determinism doesn't necessarily mean we're not responsible. It just means we're responsible in ways that are not as surface obvious as people want them to be, because that makes it easier.
Say that last part again.
So I think that the lack of free will doesn't make people not responsible for things the way a lot of people are afraid of it. It will essentially, that's why they don't want to believe that, it seems like.
Right.
I think it's just that you have to look a lot deeper to understand why people are responsible and how they're responsible. And it's not going to satisfy our wants for revenge anymore or things like that, or for what we would call justice. It's not going to satisfy that urge in us anymore, but it will, if to respect that that's the way the world really works, would probably make the world more effective in its interactions with itself, which would make everyone happier.
So do you think giving up free will does damage to the idea of justice? What are you saying?
I think that giving up free will rearranges the idea of justice so that we no longer think that people are responsible for... Essentially, it seems like free will just means that all we care about is the intentional decisions that people make. I think that your intentions are a factor in the decisions you make, but you can't control your intentions anymore. You can't intend to have different intentions. There's no way, nothing was really ever decided. And you can be mindful enough through meditation or psychedelics to experience a state where you're not just experiencing the process or the, like, I just experience moving my right arm and it feels like my free will. If I was mindful enough, what I really would have experienced is that I could have moved my left arm. I could have just wiggled my fingers. There's lots of decisions that I could have made that lost the decision to move my right arm. And I will always just take credit for whatever one wins. I never really had a choice to do anything else. It wins for neurologically mechanical reasons and environmental reasons that I, you know, there's too many to pick one specifically, but there's no me doing that. There's just my intentions are a factor, but I don't have the ability to focus on a factor and therefore make that more likely.
So it's interesting you say, I'm glad this happened because we're dropping back into consciousness. So clearly we both care about this topic. But it's interesting you said there's no me that's doing it. But if I would argue, and this is kind of more maybe the idealism perspective, is that, I mean, do you disagree kind of with Descartes that knowing that we are conscious is the most fundamental thing we do know?
I don't disagree with Descartes about that point. I disagree with how he put it. So I think therefore I am is a valid statement. I think thoughts, therefore thoughts, is the only real way to put that. And so the first thought is your awareness of the thought. And the second thought is the fact that whatever the thought that you're aware of is a real experience separate from your awareness of it. It is doing something separate from just being in your awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So your awareness is a factor in your decision-making process, which is why I think evolution held on to it once it emerged, because it helps to recalibrate and to plan and to speak, lots of things that higher functioning will allow us to do. But it also comes with this side effect of thinking that we're in control of the final decision that emerges. And that's just because I will always feel like I just chose to raise my right hand because I did just choose to raise my right hand. But the me that chose that was not conscious me who could have deliberated to do otherwise, like it feels like I could have. I just am not mindful enough to pay attention to each moment close enough to actually notice the process of the decision being, the decisions that are being rejected.
So why couldn't it be that you are what's choosing to move your right hand? You, like, what you feel is you, that consciousness is choosing that, but it's simply that you is ultimately at foundation determined. So it seems odd, but this consciousness here, wherever it came from, which it might be determined, it still is the thing choosing to raise my right hand. So I don't have to say, well, this wasn't me that did this. No, it was me and I chose it. But me was ultimately determined.
Well, I think that I'm not completely disagreeing with that. I'm saying that your consciousness is just way less of an influence than that. That assumes that it's the key influence. And I'm saying, I admit that your consciousness does have a influence over the rest of your brain and all the rest of your decision-making process. Whatever is going on in the brain that is your consciousness at that moment will then affect other things that is not your consciousness. And that is true right now about your current subconsciousness. It is affected by your previous states of consciousness. So there is an influence there, but there's no need. If that itself is a mechanism in the universe, there's no need to have anything own it.
Own it besides...
Nothing needs to own the awareness. The awareness can exist in the universe without there being an owner of the awareness. So everyone can be aware. They can have a self in terms of they really exist, but they don't have a self in terms of nothing owns their state of consciousness. It just is another fact, like the other things that are not conscious.
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by own. Like, how's that different?
Like the thinker of your thoughts, the thing that you think is thinking your thoughts.
Yeah.
I don't believe in that. I believe that all of your thoughts happen, but I think that if you just pay close enough attention to the state of your mind, that there is actually no reason to believe that the thing that happens is you. And so for example, this is a silly example, but I took psychedelics at a music festival and I was just laying in the grass listening to music. And I decided that, I really want to get up right now. And so, I mean, consciously getting up is not usually much of a task. But my body did not move at all. It didn't move at all. I just laid there. And it was a little terrifying to realize that I could not, like, no matter how much I consciously focused, it didn't do anything. I just freaked myself out. But then I just found myself walking a few minutes later with no like conscious deliberation. It seemed like my brain was like, all right, we'll go for a walk if that's what you want to do. And I just happened to realize that I had done that once I already did. I don't know how that can be explained if I have free will, but it can be explained if I think I have free will and I just never can usually be mindful enough to notice my consciousness say, oh shit, I didn't successfully control that part of the brain that time. And so that the freak out happens when it doesn't get what it predicted.
So first question, what was the band playing?
At that time it was Papa Dosio.
I feel like I've heard of them. I don't know, what type of music is that?
They're jam bandy. I would say they're jam bandy.
Fair enough. I definitely acknowledge that consciousness and the awareness of like a self is like obviously very complex. One of my friends is actually literally a neuroscientist. I need to get her on as a expert commentator. So shout out to you, Claire, if you watch this. But I guess my, like, you know, this is not something I've studied in depth, but there definitely seems to be this kind of like dialectical back and forth between consciousness informing like subconscious, but subconscious informing consciousness. And it's complex because like, obviously your experience at the music festival shows, and yet, I guess I really do hold to the fact that as soon as we try to escape the idea of qualia, of just this awareness that I'm a thing, thinking, it seems to get right back in as soon as we try to escape it. So like, even though you're watching your body do something and you're not fully in control of it, you still feel like something there experiencing that. So do you just feel like that's an illusion ultimately?
I don't know if illusion is the right word. I think it's a misunderstanding.
Well, let me ask you this.
So
we've talked about this a little bit over text, which is the idea of like a philosophical zombie, the idea that, and I think this is in what's David Chalmers calls the hard problem of consciousness. And, so it's the idea that you could picture Ryan at the music festival experiencing everything that you see, but there's actually no inner experience happening, what's called qualia. So basically the idea of a super advanced Android that never becomes self-aware, that it acts like it's like Amazon Alexa, where it can talk to you, but it's super advanced, but there's no actual Alexa inside there feeling things. So like, I guess my question is, don't we know we're not philosophical zombies? And if so, why aren't we philosophical zombies? Like, it seems like this extra thing added on.
Okay, in reverse order, I cannot answer where consciousness comes from right now. But I don't think that philosophical zombies are actually possible. And I would actually use the same example of my music festival experience to prove that, because I'm not sure how a philosophical zombie could lay on the ground terrified that his consciousness didn't have control. It wouldn't have a consciousness to realize it wasn't in control, and so there'd be no logical step from there to terror. I think that, so consciousness is playing a role in our brain that is irremovable. You can't get rid of it and still have a person the way we think of one. But it isn't the person itself. It is the experience of the person at any one moment, but it isn't their identity. It's just what it feels like to be them at that point in time.
But obviously it's like, excuse me. It's like a helpful abstraction to talk about, because I mean, it's our most intuitive experience that I'm a person.
Okay, so I think that it's intuitive that the Earth is flat. It's intuitive that the sun goes around the Earth. And certain things that are intuitive, when better understood, can be given up without things actually changing how they seem. You can just understand why they seem that way, which is essentially what my point is that I don't think it's ever going to seem like we don't have free will, but eventually we will be educated enough, which we already kind of are, but eventually it'll be so simple that it'll be essentially undeniable that no one is making free will kind of choices, and that consciousness is real, but it is not owned by anyone. There's no, I don't have a consciousness that this thing called Ryan is controlling somewhere. There's no controller. There's no locus of Ryan somewhere in my brain. It's all networking, and the networking is valuable.
Yeah. I guess for me, like I would say the philosophical zombie example of you at the concert would be someone who behaved in all those ways, but obviously wasn't having that inner experience. So you're right. It is logically impossible that you have a zombie that is questioning its own existence because it's not a zombie anymore at that point. Right. So, but I still struggle understanding the purpose of qualia, I guess. It just seems like it's this magical thing that appears when something gets advanced enough. And I guess it's hard for me to believe, like, we make a computer more and more advanced, and I mean, all of a sudden it's going to have this inner experience the way we do, I guess.
I don't know. I am not advocating that this is in any way the answer. This is total philosophy, sure. Just conjecture. But when I see a reflection in the water of a mirror that I'm holding that is reflecting an image of my friend, and so I'm seeing a reflection of a reflection, it's like data transmission, and my friend is not in the water, and he's not in the mirror, and he's not, like, his dimensions appear to be to the mirror from my point of view. And I'm not necessarily saying that it's that simple, but that I don't think that with just the qualities themselves, I don't necessarily know why we doubt that they would have seemingness. I don't know on what grounds seemingness is. So, like, what makes
are you using seemingness qualia essentially?
Yeah. So what makes red seem red rather than blue, or make it seem like a high pitched sound? Why is red seem red?
Yeah.
To me, that is because the structure of our eyes and the structure of our brain and the associations that it is capable of making and how that is useful in a networking fashion and just the evolutionary possibilities of what we have. I don't know necessarily that we can say that it is possible for us not to experience the red we're seeing. We don't actually know that it's possible to not be conscious just because we don't understand the actual, if it's microtubules or whatever they're looking into now, that actually causes it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously it is, I mean, it's crazy how the most, probably the most inscrutable thing in our existence is inside our own head. Like, what the heck is consciousness? Like, it's probably the most mysterious thing in the universe at this point, or at least top three, let's say. And it is very hard to get at. I guess at some point, the hard problem of consciousness just sunk in for me. Part of it is like, are you familiar with like Thomas Nagel, the What It's Like to Be a Bat essay? Yeah. So Thomas Nagel, or the listener, is an atheist philosopher who, man, he really embodies a lot of what we're talking about as far as like honesty and stuff. Like you feel like you're getting a very genuine take. He wrote a book recently that I think I bought on Kindle or I got for Christmas called, he's an atheist, and he wrote why the like atheist materialist reductionist view of the world is almost certainly wrong. Have you heard about this?
Yes, yes.
You haven't read it, have you?
No, I just know of.
All right, yeah, I mean, I don't know much about it, but it's just that title, the fact of who he is writing it, just made me laugh, kind of. And I guess I think I feel haunted by the idea of consciousness the same way I get the impression that someone like Thomas Nagel is. And I mean, with all these things, I don't think it proves the existence of God or anything like that, but I guess I have an easier time picturing everything being the way it is, but us being robots with no inner experience. And so that presses on me. Why then do we have this inner experience? Why do, yeah.
Okay. I would like to say, I don't know the answer to these questions.
Yes.
But it's possible that inner experience is, so it's an inherent part of your nervous system, but the richness of it is not. And so it's possible that the human conscious experience is so rich and thick because our brains are so well connected and the information gets shared around so easily. And if you damage certain parts of our brain, we lose a lot more consciousness in a lot specific areas than if you damage other parts.
Right.
And so I think that our brains are obviously the answer, because damaging them is the problem. If we can reverse engineer that, I suppose. And
yeah.
So I just don't see how consciousness, I don't know how to say this. It's not necessarily as magical as it seems, just like free will. It's possible that I could hear things, and to my hearing, I could hear them before my brain had the capacity to connect my hearing with my visuals and realize that that's coming from your mouth. And before all that could come together and realize that this is on a podcast. And so I think the human richness of experience might be why it seems so magical, and that it's possible that animals hear things just like we hear them, but they don't hear them and also experience their sight as one collected experience. Everything is just independently processed. And in that way, consciousness can kind of have little proto-consciousnesses that accidentally combine in the human mind just due to its structure.
Yes. And I mean, I think I would agree with that. I think there is clearly, there seems to be this spectrum of consciousness. Like, I don't think, like if you're, you know, not a human, you automatically don't, you're just a robot, an organic robot. And obviously among humans, like brain damage or whatnot, it's even people who have experienced some trauma, and they clearly describe what at least seemed to them like a lesser form of consciousness and then coming back to full consciousness, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, I was going to say something else about the other thing is, and yes, I absolutely do not feel like I have, I mean, like I said, consciousness is one of the most mysterious things, and it clearly is very, very tied to the brain. And I mean, for most purposes, yeah, it just seems like the brain. Like, I'm fully willing to admit that. One analogy I've heard from some Christian philosophers is that consciousness works with the brain the same way a pianist plays the piano, which is appropriate for us two musicians. So as soon as you damage the piano, I mean, there's no redeeming it. Like, you can't, like, the pianist can play, they can't fix the broken key, but there still is a pianist there. So I don't know how much I, like, this is, the funny thing for me talking about this is 5 years ago or so, like, I almost was like a Christian materialist when it came to humans, especially. Like, so this is a little more recent for me that, like I said, it's been more recent that, like, what's called the hard problem of consciousness has felt more like it sinks in. But let me ask you one question about free will and justice that I'll be curious to see if we're on the same page with, because this is irrespective of if there's anything supernatural. I actually heard a clip of Sam Harris on another podcast, and the host, who's a skeptic, to me makes this huge misstep in reasoning that it's unnecessary as an atheist. And I wish, I don't think Sam Harris calls him out, but I want to hear what you think. Basically, so they're talking about free will, and then if free will is, I guess, phenomenological or just like kind of an illusion, that then everything's determined. And the host was saying this had struck him so much, this idea, that he had recently broken up with his girlfriend, and I think he even admitted to doing something. I don't think he cheated on her or anything, but he said it was like his fault or something. And he said, but this is what it struck me. He was like, I don't really regret it because I couldn't have done otherwise. Like, that was clearly, since I'm determined, that's exactly how I had to behave. So my big problem with that is, I think you can fully accept determinism, but you still have to recognize that things come through at least some form of an agency, of a what at least feels like you're making decisions. So this let's call him Jeff, the podcast host. Jeff, looking back on this situation, that Jeff might be just as determined, but in both cases, he at least feels like he's making decisions. So it's almost like Jeff was saying, oh wait, I'm determined, therefore I'm just gonna like sit around and do this until something, you know, pulls my strings. And it's like, well, that's clearly the case. Like, so I feel like there are definitely significant issues with justice and stuff if determinism is true. But at the least, we feel like we're choosing things, and that I'm sure Jeff felt like he could have made other decisions at that time. We can argue if he actually could have, but it's but clearly thinking you can make different choices allows you to, or changes how you make choices in the future. Like, I mean, just psychologically, if you talk to counselors, that when people, there's a thing, actually I wrote about this in one blog post called locus of control, feeling like you have internal locus of control or the world is controlling you. And so even if it's all robotic, if we tell someone they have choice, then they make different choices after that, and usually better choices. So I don't know, to me, it was this total reduction of like, oh wait, if free will is an illusion, then I can get up and murder a bunch of people, and well, that's all I could do. When it's like, wait, you were jumping like 8 steps there. So I don't know, what's your take on that?
I think I agree with most of what you just said. I think that the guy who decided that he's not responsible for his decisions because he couldn't have done otherwise is misunderstanding how responsibility works. So you can't do something and not be responsible for it. It doesn't matter why. You are responsible for the things that you do. My Sam Harris uses the example a lot of the clock tower shooter who had been discovered to have a tumor in his head. And he wrote letters saying that he felt this problem. And when he was dead, look at his brain and see if there's anything there. And they found a tumor exactly where they would expect it to be to have those kinds of problems.
Wow.
Is that guy responsible for those decisions, knowing that he felt off and everything?
Yeah.
Well, I would say that consciously, the way we want to hold him responsible, he is not responsible for those decisions. And if we can remove the tumor, he doesn't need to be punished because there's absolutely no one left to decide anything like that. He's not like that. The
yes.
previous state of his brain was like that. He's not responsible in that way, but he is still responsible for the lives that he took at that time. And so there does still need to be some system where we're not punishing people for things they have no control over, but we are still holding people accountable for the actions that they make in their life.
Yes. Yeah. Well said. And yeah, the shooter example, that adds a further wrinkle because, like you said, you're really dealing with almost two hims, to a version of him that is compromised deeply and a version of him that isn't without the tumor. That makes it far more complex. But with this podcast host, there's only one him. And it's like, we can analyze all day what he is, you know, as a robot, you know? Okay.
I think that every single moment he's a different him and that he's essentially branching his responsibility.
Yes.
He's saying that, well, my good decisions, those are me, and my bad decisions, those are determined. He's been determined to say that and to feel as not responsible as he does at the moment, but we're also determined to know that he's wrong about that. And he's determined to deal with the repercussions of being wrong about that.
Yes. No, you brought up, okay. So you brought up the whole, if you take determinism, you know, fully and materialism, then you could say that, there is no consistent you, that you're like a different one at each moment. I would love, and maybe we'll do this, if you want to come back on, there's a debate between William Lane Craig and Alex Rosenberg, I believe, who is a philosopher of, I guess, like consciousness and metaphysics, and who is an atheist materialist. And William Lane Craig uses what you just said and a few other points. And he tries to argue that when you commit to that materialist free consciousness is an illusion, then you end up in all these absurd places, like that there is no continual you, that it's a different you at each step, free will doesn't exist and causes problems for moral responsibility. What I think he really tried to tag him on is that Alex Rosenberg ended up denying states of intentionality, that you couldn't actually think about something because that gets weird to me. I mean, yeah. I'm out of my philosophical pay grade, but basically his point was that Alex Rosenberg was right to go down those paths, but you end up in places that are becoming so against our common experience, they seem questionable. But yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting to both listen to that because, like, I also identify with the idea that, you know, obviously there are things that are unintuitive, but when you get down to the roots of them, that fact is true, even though it's not intuitive.
We can definitely talk about some ideas about reviewing debates together at the same time.
Atheist yes.
And Christian review atheist and Christian debates.
That could be really funny. We could be like a Mystery Science Theater 3000, but that'd be great. Love it. Well, this has been super fun, Ryan. I'm glad we got to actually talk. Closing thoughts of any sort?
I did have one question for you.
Okay.
What exactly does believing in God help you explain? It doesn't have to be one particular thing, but yeah. the most. What does it really help you explain? How is it useful in your day-to-day life?
Okay, yeah. I think there's a lot of different things I would argue it does. It's a little hard to say, like, what's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, for me, it has ended up being the most settled worldview for as new phenomena comes up. And it might question it, challenge it at first, but then ultimately, Christianity has been the model that has made the most sense of what I see in the world. And there are plenty of times that at first it's the direct opposite, of course, like evil, you know. So, as I go out and around the world, what I experience over time cumulatively has made the most sense in the Christian worldview. So just thinking deeply about just as simple as why is there anything at all? And then these deeper things that don't necessarily strike you right at first, but to me, the more I've thought about them, which is like consciousness, morality, the things that we value most in life seem to be in danger if atheism is true, is how I would put it. It's not that they can't have a foundation. Maybe you could argue they do, but they at least seem to be on the choppy block that and some atheists have discarded, like, you know, morality and consciousness and stuff like that. In a more experiential, sharp sense, it would be the actual experience with the supernatural, I would say, and mostly in a mild way of just my own relationship with God, and seeing both how that's works in my life, and also even like the stranger things, like coincidences, but bigger than that as well. And then, I mean, the really big stuff is when you get into like miracles and stuff, which is, I think, will be a future discussion. That's, in fact, I was thinking about that today, like what would be, you know, the best argument, or what I think is like the best argument for God or something. And I think it takes time to get absorbed in and to dig into, but I think actual like miracles and supernatural stuff, like phenomena, is that powerful. One thing I like to say is that has become fundamental data of the universe for me. So if I felt like Christianity was false for other reasons, I think I would still believe in the supernatural because of what I've learned about and experienced so far. So I wouldn't know what it was or where it was coming from, but I would say there's something out there. So I think in the most like kind of immediate sense, it would be that stuff. And then the thing that makes me comfortable in a Christian worldview is the over time. It's made sense of things other worldviews couldn't. And the things that didn't make sense within Christianity that really endangered it seemed to end up finding resolution when I thought it wouldn't, which to me gave more credence to it. So that's, I don't know, that's best.
It's a good enough answer for me.
All right, since you threw me a question, I did prepare one for you, and I would just be curious what you think is the best argument for God, if there is one, if you can even rank them, and what do you think is the best argument against God? And you can take that as God generally or the Christian God, however you think.
The best argument for God is... The best argument for God is any argument of the God of the gaps. So if you can say, we don't know where blank came from, you're at least trying to say that God explains something we haven't already explained, instead of trying to take an explanation we already know we have and substitute God there, because that's not going to work anymore. So I think, although I don't like God of the gaps arguments because I think they're arguments from ignorance, I do think that ultimately that's the best. If you're going to hypothesize God, you got to put him somewhere. And so these are going to have to go in the gaps. Right. And I can't be that upset that that's the way that has to be.
Yeah, like you said, they're at least trying to explain something.
Right, yeah. And the best argument against God, it depends on what level you want to talk. I would say if you can comprehend and agree that free will is a misapprehension of the way we perceive our own consciousness, then that is definitely because it undermines the need for God. I think the best argument against God, in my personal opinion, is the fact that there's no need for that to explain anything. If you don't need a mechanism to explain something, then I wouldn't propose it. And the amount of things that God has ever explained has been reducing forever. And that trend, I think, is very unlikely to just like bottom out and there's some God there at the bottom who was just hiding the whole time and we just happened to pick that topic last.
Right.
So the trend happens to be, if I admit the way the pattern has gone, even if though I was raised Catholic or Christian, I don't think that it's reasonable to follow a tradition that doesn't seem like it's going to play out in the long run.
Right, right. Like if you can see the direction it's trending. Yeah.
Yep.
That's interesting. You seem to be, I would say you're unlike most atheists that I meet in the sense that you do seem to really resonate with the broad ideas of what needs explaining and what explanations we have available. Whereas a lot of skeptics and just doubters, I know it's these more sharp things about the problem of evil or the Bible or stuff like that. So does that...
Those are easy targets. And I think everybody already knows what they think about that. Those debates have already happened. Yeah. If anyone was going to be swayed by them, then they're already going to be when they get introduced to those things. But they're not really my position. My honest position is that, like I said earlier, a lot of atheists don't even care about those broad things. And that was one of the most discouraging things from becoming an atheist that I think I experienced was being one of the only ones who really seemed to care to think about it. Because a lot of people, I mean, they'll care if you get them high, but they're not going to care really in the big picture, most of them. And so I enjoy having conversations with intelligent Christians more than I enjoy having conversations with less intelligent atheists, even though they agree with me, because I don't think that going after easy targets and really means that you know what you're talking about. It just means that you've heard somebody else who's very educated about something and you're going to base your whole position on their position.
Well said. Definitely fully agree. Yeah, this has been super fun. I definitely want to link, you said you had one song, one YouTube, right? Yeah. Awesome. Perfect. So I would love to link that. And if you, I don't know if you feel like sharing your, Twitter or anything like that, you don't blog. You
not very often. I'll share this podcast on my Facebook page and things like that.
Okay, cool. Well, like I said, it's been super fun, and I definitely think we should at least talk about miracles once I've been kind of working on this, like sort of like a essay/paper of trying to just put all the best stuff together, and I would love for you to read it and us talk about it, because I think it's one of the provoke some of the most interesting conversations, without a doubt, because a lot of the philosophical stuff is interesting to certain ilk, but it can just sound like, what are you talking about, qualia, and am I a continual person? You know, a lot of people, it just gets in the weeds, but miracles, it's like, you know, it's like either this thing happened and that's crazy, man, or it's a big hoax, which is super fascinating too, you know, or whatnot. So anyway, it's been super fun, Ryan, and I look forward to future discussions.
Thank you. I'd happy to have them.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Yep.
Bye.